All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode. After a long time back on the podcast, Mr. Menno Henselmans. Menno, how's it going?
Very good. Yeah. Busy. And now we're fellow YouTubers.
Yeah. Now we're fellow YouTubers. You're very active now on the platform, and that's interesting. It's actually taken me some time to get used to it even. So I'm imagining that for you, it was especially strange because for a long time you were kind of reluctant to, like, I've seen a lot of people suggesting it to you and mm-hmm. you're like, I'm more of a writer. Like, I like the long form stuff better. What made you even get into it at this point?
I think it's funny because YouTube used to be kind of what TikTok is now. And now YouTube is actually, I think, relatively intellectual and people are much more appreciative of long form content. So it used to be like the advent of video was met with, for a lot of writers and the like, the idea of, okay, now it's all video, you know, the people can't read anymore. But now actually long form content and video is so ubiquitous that long form content, whether it's writing or in video, is most appreciated on YouTube and blogs. Blogs are, they're still there, I suppose, but video is definitely becoming super, super popular compared to articles.
And was this something that you just observed and then you decided, or you researched this as well, like you do most things?
I researched it a bit, but the community aspect was mostly going by feel, and I thought, well, let's just try it. You know, for a year, I put on a video every week, and I can already say it's pretty successful because the channel is growing quite well. Some videos have taken off, but of course, I would say it's very difficult to get people from a different channel to your YouTube. That's much more difficult than I thought.
Oh yeah.
But overall, people are super appreciative. I like the YouTube community a lot because, like I said, people are much more appreciative, much more. They communicate much more like people would in one-to-one, in-person interaction, I feel, as opposed to social media. Twitter is particularly nasty sometimes. And Instagram also can be hit or miss. I think Instagram is a great platform, but yeah, you do reach the mainstream, and that comes with also reaching a lot of people that are not your core audience.
Speaking of the audiences, because I've heard you mention this a number of times. So Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, like, how would you rank the community amongst those three?
I like the Facebook community, but it's dying. It's dying very rapidly. I mean, if you look at just the engagement on most people, like many influencers or evidence-based fitness professionals, whatever, they are even migrated completely away from Facebook. Some don't even use it anymore. It's usually used very as a secondary platform. And if you look at, for example, my analytics growth, it was pretty much linear up to 56,000. And then it grew a little bit more to 58. And then basically I've been at 58 for the last like 3 or 4 years until finally I realized, hey, this stuff isn't working anymore. And then I started on Instagram doing exactly the same thing I did on Facebook. And I grew to 80K in just in no time. And then when I switched from posting first on Instagram to instead of Facebook, like I would post on the main platform, Facebook first, and then I would repost on Instagram. I switched that around and then I grew on Instagram from like 80K to 100 in no time. And now at 140. So just, the people are not there on Facebook. I'm doing the exact same thing, but there are not more people there, I feel.
Yeah, and it's I feel like it's such a shame. Like I feel like Facebook had the most potential out of all of these platforms. Maybe YouTube is a bit different, but Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, I feel like Facebook is just so much more versatile. You can do so much more stuff, like so much more room for creativity. You can do long form, short form, you can post videos, whatever. I don't know, like, is everything doomed to die eventually? It's such a shame.
Yeah, I mean, we are from the generation where we paid for functionality. So yeah, if something came out with more functionality, we were like, oh, great. But now people actually pay a premium, or at least they give their attention or their time, to things with less functionality. Because you're absolutely right that if you purely look at it objectively from a rational point of view, Facebook can do everything that Instagram and Twitter can, but better and more.
Yeah.
Just it's especially compared to Twitter, right? Like, why would, if somebody said, hey, look, I got Facebook, but without this and this and this and this, and you can only post like very short posts. And if rationally speaking, people would be like, are you serious? But it was super successful. And Instagram is like, well, let's just take away everything except the pictures. And then later they were like, oh, TikTok's doing well. Let's add the videos.
Yeah. And just on the YouTube thing for 1 second, like one reason I like YouTube is precisely for what you said, is that you can do long form stuff and people have a room, people have room for that, or a time for that. And I'm noticing that you're kind of going with the trend these days of shorter, like a lot of YouTube shorts. Is that something that you also prefer to do, or that's what seems to be most effective now based on your research?
I think I use it when it's possible. There are just some things I cannot put in short form, and then I make videos or articles. And often you also see that many of the shorts actually are just short form variations of something I wrote about in an article or made a video about. So a lot of the shorts and the like are either something I feel like in 90 seconds I can give some information on this, and it's useful for that. And because sometimes people are not interested in long form, like me too. Sometimes you just want to watch something quick, and it's useful for that. But I feel like I really need YouTube, and I'm going to keep writing articles on my website as well, because some things you cannot convey in 90 seconds.
Right. Now, I wanted to ask you as well. So we are going to touch on some fitness stuff, but I don't have like... I think we can get through that relatively swiftly. So I want to ask a few more of these non-conventional stuff from you. So you mentioned that you're working on a new book at the moment. So you wrote about productivity and self-control in your last book, and you're exploring some not fitness-related topics again. Is that correct?
Yep. The book is going to be more... exactly what I talked about, when some things I cannot convey in 90 seconds, and some things just require a lot of introduction and certain knowledge before you can get to the conclusions. Mm-hmm. And the book is going to be like that, very much like the other book, where the first two chapters are an explanation of certain psychological concepts that you need to be aware of before you can understand the rest of the book. So it's going to be exactly the same, but I will say the book is probably not going to be like not in the next 2 years for sure. And yeah, might be postponed even longer, because I have some other things planned, and currently my schedule is super, super full. YouTube, of course, is one of them that also takes a lot of time, as you probably know as a content creator. Making a video is a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. People think that only the most amazing, like Jeff Nippert style videos, are those that take a lot of time. Like, no, man, like when it's just a crappy video of me sitting there, trust me, that's a lot of time.
Yeah.
And so, okay, that's cool. You talked a lot about, in various podcasts, like kind of just touched on it here and there, like your general philosophies on living well, basically. And that's sort of like what your next book would be about, roughly, like, right?
Kind of evidence-based approach to life.
Yeah. And I'm very, very much interested in that, because I feel like there's so much talk about that, but that being combined with the whole like evidence-based approach is not something that I've really seen. And so actually someone suggested a question that I should ask you when I talk to you now. And that was, do you have like some sort of evidence-based definition for like what happiness is?
I mean, in economical terms, it's defined specifically as the affective component of happiness, which is in psychological research usually called subjective well-being or positive affect. And it's quite literally is measured by how happy you feel. So in the end, I think that for most intents and purposes, that is the most important thing. Now, there are definitely things that result in long-term happiness, that you currently don't feel yet. So there are things which is typically, but I think when people say something is meaningful, they are referring to either long-term happiness or not necessarily happiness, but more of an evolutionary success strategy. Like in evolutionary terms, that is something that works well, like having a lot of children. And yeah, I think that's the definition that we should also use, because for practical intensive purposes, if it doesn't actually make you feel better for, you know, often, what does it mean? Like life satisfaction, for example, is a concept that psychologists have looked at, and it's associated much more strongly with financial success, whereas that's very different from the subjective well-being component, which is not nearly as strongly associated with financial success. So then I think it's very prudent to ask yourself the question, if you're going by life satisfaction, okay, like objectively, you think you're very satisfied with life, but if you're not feeling happy, what does that give you? You know, that's the idea that you're successful, but you're not feeling happy. I don't think that matters.
Yeah. And then, so then how does one, I mean, now you alluded to this, but what is a good way to kind of reconcile the time frames here? Because yeah, as you said, like some things, or like delayed gratification is an important part of living a very, at the very least, a successful life in today's world, but probably also a happy one in the long term.
Yep. And I think that's where research really comes in, to inform us of the things that over the long run make us happier, even if in the short run they don't. For example, happiness research finds that health is an absolutely crucial component of happiness when you extend it to the long term. And it makes so much sense, because if you're looking on the effect of morbidity, like most research looks at longevity, but I think morbidity is far more interesting, which is basically the quality of your life. Okay, a lot of people, when they're 60 years old, they already have 5 types of ailments and conditions and limitations, but nothing that will kill them. So they will still live up to 80 years old. But then if you look at the quality of that life for the remaining 20 years, it can be really bad. Whereas if you are staying healthy, that quality can be really good until you're close to the end. Of course, eventually, you know, it's going to decline. But if you can live a life where you're relatively physically active, you have no problems carrying your own groceries, these types of things, and then at some point, you know, you die in your sleep, that's, I think, a good life that has a lot of values over those last 20 years like that.
Yeah. And so, for example, different components like your social circle, where you live, these little things, obviously, I mean, these are not little things, but these things will have an impact on how you feel day to day, obviously. But then there are also things like your financial situation. But then beyond that, there is also like, how much do you like your work? And how much do you feel like your work is having an impact? So that is like, does it give you a sense of purpose each day? Like, some of these things are, I guess, even hard to measure, but they do contribute to well-being. Is there some sort of a breakdown that you found for like which matters most, which not so much?
Well, there's tons of research on that, which is definitely something I intend to go into. Although there's so much research that I'm not even sure if I have the space to devote just one chapter to it. But some components, for example, that make a job more happiness generating than another job is, one, the environment. Traditional cubicle office space environment is quite bad. And if you replace that with almost anything else, people perform quite a bit better. And that explains, for example, why hairdressers are relatively healthy. Some professions like clergy and religious jobs are also, they score very well in terms of happiness. And that's attributed in large part to the meaningfulness component of what they do, as well as being out of an office and having direct social interaction. Having direct social interaction with your end consumers or clients, or just however you want to call it, is super, super useful for to be happy. Because if you do something and you don't see that it makes anyone better off, it's not nearly as rewarding. Whereas if you do something and it directly makes someone else better off and they tell you, that is very good for happiness. And I've also found that myself very prominently as a business consultant, where I was like, okay, so today I designed an algorithm that made this insurance company get more out of their customers. Basically, I helped them rip their clients off better. And it's like, Not exactly something you go to your kids later and say, like,
yeah.
"Hey, Johnny, listen what Daddy did today." So it's enough if you compare that to personal training, which doesn't have the same glamour, at least not the corporate glamour. But you help somebody and they tell you, "You changed my life. I feel so much better now," and you know, they literally feel like you're a new person. That, of course, is a hugely different effect rather than you're just a pat on the back from the manager.
Yeah, for sure. Another good suggestion I got from someone, but actually I'm just going to call him Tim because you know him. You probably know multiple Tims, but anyways, so he suggested to me a great question to ask you, and maybe that will be my last one on this, is for how many people do you think the kind of lifestyle that you're living is for? Because obviously you find a lot of fulfillment in it, and I'm guessing it makes you happy. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it and wouldn't have for so long, especially. Do you think that you're unique in that you can make this work so well, or you think that this would be like a good way to be for most people?
I think most people should not live a life as extreme as mine. The amount of traveling I did in particular, and still do by most standards, is probably too much for most people. In particular, because it's very difficult to build a lasting social circle. And that is one of the things that is the most important for happiness for most people. So my social circle is spread pretty much around the globe. And it actually, in my case, helps a lot that I have a large public following. So whenever people learn that I'm somewhere, or whenever I go to a good gym in a place, there are usually people that recognize me. And then you immediately have kind of a social circle there. So in Croatia, they had a really good gym, and there a lot of people recognized me. And in Portugal, also, a lot of people recognize me. So you immediately have connections with people, and that also helps. Whereas if you're completely alone somewhere, then, yeah, over the long run, that's a lot harder. So I think that's a big component that people might not, when they think of the nomad life and traveling all the time, they might not immediately realize that. Yes, short-term social connections can also be fruitful, but in the long run, you're often not building anything lasting. So that's a big downside, I think, for most people. And in some ways I'm flexible, in other ways, maybe not. But when it comes to traveling, I am quite flexible. And the minimalist idea of having all of your life belongings in two suitcases, I think many people should probably can learn a lot from that, because most people have way too much stuff. And then the stuff owns them instead of them owning the stuff. But the way the extremity of my situation is probably not for most people. Like, it's a lot of change. It can be quite stressful.
What about just entrepreneurship in general? Obviously, like, you gotta be able to have a skill and to actually sell it and whatever. But like, should that be a goal for most people to at least at one point transition to that sort of setup, or do you think that that's like 50-50, or like most people should not attempt something like that? What do you think?
On average, entrepreneurs are happier than non-entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
But there is probably significant survivorship bias there, whereby people that are entrepreneurs are probably somewhat successful entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the statistics, I think it's 90% of businesses fail within the first 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's painful, right?
Yeah.
And if you just look around how most people run a business, it's not that hard to understand. Like, people open a restaurant. I know some people, for example, they're the perfect example. They moved to Spain from the Netherlands, had never been in Spain before, but they just, you know, saw the postcard and thought it was awesome. Open a restaurant without having done any research about the location, the costs, or anything. It was a total disaster. They didn't do any SEO optimization. They weren't even on Google Maps. You know, they had to figure out everything on the fly. They didn't prepare. And then they just thought, well, because we think our food is awesome, everyone will flock to us and we'll have an amazing business. We're going to be the best restaurant in town. Yeah, that didn't pan out. And within about a year, they were like, "Your Spain sucks. Let's go back."
Yeah. So at this point, we're making slowly a transition towards fitness topics. You travel a lot, and are you, I mean, I know you took up kickboxing not long ago, so that's kind of a new thing, but you know, for the decade before that, you were basically traveling to places and training, like resistance training every day. Is that correct?
That's pretty much right.
Did that at any point become kind of like a chore for you or something where you had some cognitive dissonance that you had to resolve at times? Like, does this still make you happy? Am I just keeping this up out of like stubbornness? Am I basically like, have I fallen into a trap laid by myself that like now I am the high frequency, like train every day guy. I set up everything around this. Now I have to do it, even though I don't enjoy it anymore. I've had moments like that at times. I'm going to be honest. I'm curious if you've ever had something like that.
I have, and I've tried different things. Definitely not like I felt I should do it because of my reputation or anything, because I don't feel married to the concept. I'm still a proponent generally of higher frequencies, but because the research, if you look at research on training frequency, we can do an intermezzo about actual fitness.
Yeah.
It's, if you purely look at the results, right? Let's let you go into it. And I tell you, there's a training technique. And in most studies, especially in trained individuals, there is no difference. It's not beneficial. It's not hurtful. It's not more work. It's just a different way to set up your program. But there are multiple studies that find significant benefits. And there's only one study, which is, there's a lot of limitations. In one of the four muscle studies, there was a negative effect. So essentially no negative research to speak of. And at least five or so solid studies, and then five or so more, somewhat trendy or trend finding studies that show there might be significant benefits, especially at higher training volumes for more serious trainees that are more advanced. Would you do it? Especially if you're more advanced, well-trained, training multiple times, doing high volume, then probably yes, right? Because there's no downside and there's significant upside. Well, that is the state of research on training frequency.
Yeah, yeah. Did you find it enjoyable though? I guess the reason why that's even a question is because I know that for a very long time, I could not imagine that could ever even become a question, because I was so excited to just go to the gym and to make plans on like, what can I achieve this week, this month, this year? Obviously there came a time, not that I became defeatist in my mindset or anything, like I still wanted to improve, but like, okay, like it's pointless to make big plans for this month because nothing is going to happen this month. Probably not even in this 6 months, maybe by the end of the year, I'm going to eke out something and that's going to be great. But obviously it's hard to be as enthusiastic on a moment-to-moment basis about that. So at that point, like you need to look a bit deeper or just rely on the routine or whatever and just go with that. So that's why this is even a question. Like, did that become a chore? Like, oh man, going to the gym again, that kind of thing.
Okay, so there's two components to this. There's the total training frequency, like going to the gym every single day, and there's the high frequency setup. Because you can also go to the gym every day with a bro split, right? And the high frequency component of it is something that I very much enjoy because it's way more time efficient. You can do combo sets, and most of my workouts are done in 45 minutes, sometimes 30 minutes. Because I literally, especially now with the kickboxing, my work capacity is really good. And I rest maybe 1 minute in between sets most of the time. So my average minutes per set is probably 90 seconds or something, which means my workouts are really quick. And it's very difficult to do that if you have like push day, because if you know, set up bench press, what are you going to do afterwards? You have to recover unless you can use short rest intervals, but that's suboptimal for muscle growth and strength development. So yeah. I love the high frequency component to set up everything as wing combo sets. And I go from leg curl to squat to chin ups, etc.
Yeah. Do you know how many sets you do in total in an average workout?
About 20, I think. If it's higher volume, when I'm cutting, probably sometimes it's only 10.
Okay. So 20 sets, and that would take you how long roughly?
Yeah, I'm guessing half an hour, 45 minutes, all included, like in and out of the door.
That is amazing. And did you, so I know we've even had some back and forth. I don't know if you remember on Facebook on like how you can make these combo sets work. Did you ever get any kind of shit from people in a gym where you like left an equipment, piece of equipment there, like loaded up, let's say, and then like you, any kind of issue?
Yeah, you have to look at the norms of the gym. And definitely, I would never occupy multiple pieces of equipment at the same time. So you have to be flexible with your combo sets. Like when I'm doing squats, chin up, leg curl, I don't have the towel on the leg curl machine while I have the squat rack fully loaded up. And then I put my water bottle under the chin up bar or something. So to make sure nobody goes there, right?
Yeah.
So what I do is usually I have one thing, the squat, probably because it's the highest setup time, that I actually occupy. And if somebody else wants to join in, I'm always super flexible. But with squats, that's, you know, difficult.
Yeah.
If you have under 40 kilos or whatever on the bar, then yeah, it can be cumbersome. But if somebody wants to do it, okay, great. Now, normally, if I would do squats, I would rest like 5 minutes in between sets. So especially after hard sets, which means that I have basically 5 minutes in my mind to do other stuff. And it doesn't make anyone worse off because I would be there just for 5 minutes in the squat rack anyway. Especially if it's better if you can do like dumbbell overhead press, you can bring the dumbbells to a squat rack, then it's perfect. But otherwise, I literally just walk to the chin up bar, do some chin ups, go back to the squat rack. And if I have another exercise, I might do that one. Depending on the gym norms, you have to see, you know, what's okay to do. A lot of people just occupy two or more pieces of equipment. Here in Spain, it's really bad. Like they'll actually tell you, well, they're doing a different exercise. You go to a machine and you want to use the machine. They're like, I'm using that while they're doing a different exercise, right?
Oh, good.
Yeah. I'm always want to say like, you're not, like you're objectively not.
Yeah.
But, so yeah, don't be that guy. But if you just have some flexibility, so for example, and again, going back to the squats and chin-up context, let's say somebody else takes the chin-up bar, then I don't do chin-ups. I just keep squats. Worst case scenario, I do straight sets and I leave the chin-ups for later. So the worst case scenario is always that you're as worse off, as bad off, badly off, as you would be anyway if you did straight sets. So there's nothing to lose, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking of how I could do this because, and you're completely right, like you are in the same exact position, whether you stay there for 5 minutes or go somewhere else and do other stuff. But obviously, like a lot of things are in gyms and in life in general, it's not really about what is actually the practical thing to do, but about what you're signaling, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm just like having these images in my head that like, okay, I have my squat rack there and like, I'm just seeing a dude like walking up to my squat rack and is like looking around, like, is there someone using it? And then someone points at me and it looks over and it's like shaking its head, like what a dickhead. He just like left his shit here, like loaded up. And it's like, if I could actually have a conversation with him, I could explain like, hey, so like I would be still resting there, but I'm here. So which would be not such a big deal, but since it's my gym that I'm using all the time, I would not want to be looked at as the asshole. But I'm sure there are ways around it. Like if you don't load up things with a plate, but it's just like some stack loaded machine, then I guess you don't run into this problem. So maybe there are some,
if you, for example, if you're in a gym, which is like the gym I was just in Portugal, where they're extremely strict with all the equipment. In fact, even if you use a cable pulley, they want you to put back the handle. So everything they want to be put back, essentially, so that at any point in time, if anyone finishes their set, they could close up the gym and there would be no cleaning. That's kind of the idea. Yeah. In that gym, you have to just do more work. So I would, for example, combine a cable exercise with something else. Then I would get the cable, put it on the cable, do a set of pushdowns or whatever, put the cable back, go to the leg extension machine, do a set of leg extensions where it's easy because it's stack loaded. So you just put it in and ready to go. Then you clean the leg extension machine. You go to the next one. It's a little bit more work, but it still saves a lot of time.
Yeah. I'm sure you get questions about or clients that are busy are telling you that this is a hectic period. So I'm thinking of instead of 6 days a week, I'm going to go to the gym 3 days a week, whatever. And I'm sure you also generally give them the answer that, well, like you're not necessarily saving time this way. Like you can really keep your workouts very short and there are many, many ways to save time. And I'm curious how you go about this yourself, because what I've noticed is that usually what actually takes up time is not really the workout itself, but it's that general sink, like that hole that the workout is creating in the middle of your day. So you go there, like you the travel time, then wasting too much time in the gym, then the post-workout meal, then crashing after that, whatever. So it's like something could actually take like 45 minutes and it ends up taking 3 hours often. How do you go about it? Like, did you develop some cool systems for yourself to actually be time efficient in this regard?
Yeah, I think for me, it's actually a benefit that it breaks up my day because I use it as a break where I work hard before and at some point I'm pretty much spent. So my productivity would be down enormously anyway. And I found that, yeah, I can push it for another few hours, but my productivity per hour is going to be so poor that I'm literally better off, or at least equally well off, if I have to break and then do the same amount of work in 1 hour that would normally take me 3 hours. If I kept like, you know, okay, one email, I'll get distracted, get back to the email, finish the email. I have to do something else now, do something else. Try to go to the next email, get distracted, you know, then when you're focused, you can do all of that in 1 hour. So yeah. I find that it actually helps. But the two big factors that to me determine whether you should be training more frequently or not, if you want to be very time efficient, are your commuting time, and if you enjoy the commute, and warm up. So warmer places in general, you don't have to do as much warm up. Some people also just need more warming up than others. You don't need a lot of warm up. You like your commute, or it's very close, like 5 minute walk to the gym. Then often you indeed don't save time when you do fewer sessions per week, because research finds that, and anecdotal experience also very strongly shows that when people do a very, very long workout, their rest intervals towards the end get longer and longer. Whereas at the start of the workout, you can do a combo set and it's like, great, Mano says I can do squats and then chin-ups. And
yeah,
you can do that. But as soon as you've done a few heavy sets, especially combo sets, you're close to spent. And then that combo set is going to be squats, 3 minutes rest, one set chin-ups, another 3 minutes rest. And then in the end, you're barely saving time. So that's very important to note. And especially with straight sets, you can get really, really poor. You're talking about 5 minutes rest in between sets of pushdowns. That's just super inefficient use of time.
Yeah. Do you, in terms of time efficiency, what do you think about the application of these intensity techniques like myo reps or something? I mean, I know you talked about it a lot. So maybe a more practical question. Like, I think we can summarize it generally by saying that all else being equal, shorter rest and getting a lot more of these failure points with short rest periods is not amazing for muscle growth. But like if someone does like, let's say, four total sets, like 3 myo rep set and like one actual like activation set, like how much worse do you think that is? Like, is it 90% as effective as 4 straight sets with enough rest, or how should we think about it?
Myo reps are very tricky. I mean, most research on this errs in the side that given the same total work volume, so sets times reps times weight, you get equal results. That's true with cluster sets, most of these inter-set techniques, pyramid systems. There's a recent review on that, actually, pyramid systems, where they show it's about equal. Cluster sets, also relatively recent meta-analysis showing equal results if the volume's equal. And so would myo reps be different? Drop sets seems to be that they're still equal when it's equal volume, but you might be able to get that already with less volume, which would be useful for saving time. But again, as a default technique, as you say, the problem is primarily that you are accumulating a lot of fatigue, and therefore you may not be able to do the same amount of volume in the first place. Plus, if you then want to scale up the volume, you're essentially in kind of a dead zone where when you scale up the volume beyond a certain point, especially if you do like drop set number 5, you're just not stimulating a lot of growth anymore.
Yeah.
So you have to switch to straight sets or something anyway. And then if you just did a drop set with 5 drop sets and then you're going to do your next set, then you're also horribly fatigued. So it's also going to be very unproductive. So yeah, they're more for saving time than for just default program with high volume working up to MRV.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, since you mentioned MRV, I'm horrible at segues. So this doesn't really work either. But one thing I wanted to bring up with you today is something that we went back and forth on in a comment section, I think, on YouTube. And that is basically the role of volume in studies versus what appears to be in real life. So I think everybody can tell even intuitively that training volume is important. But it seems to me that there's this big discrepancy between real life and then there are, you know, even practitioners like yourself. There's a lot of talk on like how to optimize your training volume. And like, it seems like sometimes it's a pretty fine balance between like doing enough versus like overdoing it, like getting into some non-functional overreaching, whatever, auto-regulation strategies. Like there are tons of things to like make us not just do mindlessly a whole bunch of volume, because it can easily be like not super productive. Whereas like in studies, so often it seems to be that like, the conclusion is just something very simple, like more volume, the better. And it's just like always comes back to that. I have my thoughts on why that could be the case, but do you, like, what do you think about what I just said?
I mean, in real life results, if you look at bodybuilders, for example, for what it's worth, I don't think it's worth a lot, but we do see that almost all the successful bodybuilders do high volume. So there are a few notable exceptions, but if you look at research surveys on bodybuilders, the vast, vast majority do high volume. I mean, you have Mansur Yates and those kind of guys, but they are, you can contrast those with Ronnie and Schwarzenegger and a lot of other more high volume guys.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say anecdotally. Plus, I think there might be some bias towards people with very high willpower and high motivation that are intuitively very keen to train to failure. They also might gravitate towards lower training volumes. And for them, actually, that makes more sense. Whereas for the average individual that is not as good as pushing themselves, they need those extra sets because they're not stimulating enough muscle growth per set on a set-by-set basis compared to the guy that goes like Yates style to true absolute momentary muscle failure.
Yeah. Do you think that... So I have this running theory with this, and just very briefly, because I said it so many times on this channel, but one of my hypotheses is that in a study where you have a limited amount of time to work with this population, probably a lot of them are relatively new still, didn't train very well, at least in the past, you have 8 weeks or whatever. Like, what is the biggest change that you can implement? It's basically to like triple their volume or whatever, like just blast them with a whole bunch of training. And that is going to have some impact, definitely, that you can measure. Like if you train like one or two reps closer to failure, I think that has an impact. But is that going to be picked up in 8 weeks? Probably not, but in years it might. So do you think that that's kind of a feasible hypothesis?
Yeah, there's a lot of research on this now, or a lot of theory, let me put it that way, because there's not a lot of empirical data. Basically, the idea is that training volume can in a large part be explained by the change in training volume rather than the absolute training volume. And there is one study that kind of suggests this is true, but had a lot of limitations. And it looked at going in trained individuals going from their baseline to plus 20% versus standard allocation of everyone. And the results of that could also be explained by the fact that trained individuals must have some idea of what their optimal volume is. And it's more likely probably that they're under than over it if you look at the average individual. Like they're probably better off doing a bit more, as you say, than a bit less. So yeah, it makes sense that in that study context, the way they studied it, you add 20% volume, they're going to get better results than just getting a flat volume, where a lot of people actually decrease their volume a lot to get to that same absolute number. It's currently still hard to say if the change in training volume matters or if it's just the absolute stimulus that matters. We do know that the optimal volume differs per individual significantly. So it is most likely the case that some strategy that optimizes volume for the individual is better than just a blanket recommendation. I think for one reason that volume might be overrated in practice compared to, especially when you coach people, is that probably most of your clients, I'm imagining, are in energy deficit. Fat loss is a more popular goal than muscle growth. And in studies, they are usually not. In studies, they are at maintenance or at energy surplus. And research on this is also not super clear, but I quite firmly believe that the MRV is lower in energy deficit than in energy surplus. Thus, the optimal estimates that we get from research about what the best number of sets per week per muscle group to do is going to be higher because we're looking at context of people in maintenance energy and like energy surplus. Plus recovery capacity, well, that you can argue both ways, but we're almost all looking at collegiate level individuals. And as tough as students like to believe they have it, it's actually not as bad as full-time jobs usually with kids and everything.
Yeah.
So probably the recovery capacity, like overall stress exposure is better in those samples than in like real life samples, especially the type of clients that you get as a PT.
Right. Now, what do you think? What do you think about this latest very interesting journey that the whole failure research, basically thingy took? It was interesting to observe it over like 2 years, because it started from like, maybe we don't need to train to failure, that maybe not even that close to failure, and then we sort of hit the peak, I feel, when it was like 5 reps in reserve is as good as training to failure. Plus, it seems like even training volume is not that important. It was like, damn, like, seriously, like, we are going to hit the peak when it's going to be like, even training is not important. Like, when we hit that, it's like all that's when I think we can all retire. But so what do you think about the state of affairs on the failure front now?
Yeah, it's interesting. We definitely, and I have to say, with decent reason to believe that train to failure is not important. There were lots of studies, especially with velocity loss thresholds coming out, and I'm skeptical of those, but coming out seemingly saying that, yeah, you just have to get basically to warm-up level and results are pretty much as good as going to failure or closer to failure. I'm super skeptical of that, especially just based on the real life test, where harder training people do consistently get better results than less hard trained people, in my view. So the idea that, you know, you just have to touch the weight and you don't have to actually do any reps doesn't really work. But the research was quite clearly moving to a consensus that train to failure is not necessary and possibly even counterproductive, especially for strength. For muscle growth, it's only counterproductive to if it decreases your total work capacity and thereby volume, I think, or it pushes down your MRV. So it's a very poor, you know, stimulus to fatigue ratio rep, especially that very last one that you fail. But then everything changed with one preprint of a meta-analysis that showed kind of the opposite, that just the closer to failure you get, the better your results.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of problems with it. It still hasn't been peer-reviewed. And the analysis is one of the type that is very popular now in evidence-based fitness. Meta-analyses in general, I think, are way too popular. Like, for God's sake, if we have two studies, don't meta-analyze them. Just do another study. But that seems to be the trend now. Oh, three studies, we're good to go. Meta-analyze them.
Yeah.
And
the highest form of evidence.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's higher in the hierarchy, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't tell you anything if you meta-analyze three studies, because they're so different that you have a good systematic review, or even a narrative review will be a lot better, that actually just looks at the studies, looks at the different people involved. What can we learn from this? Why do we get these different results? Meta-analysis starts making sense when you really get to appreciable level of studies. Anyway, this meta-analysis had enough studies, but second pitfall of current popular meta-analyses is that it's the time where you just kind of throw all the data together, like just everything, no matter the study designs, no matter the populations. And then, you know, maybe you look at some things as a covariate, like trained versus untrained. And statistically speaking, that should be okay, especially the use of covariates. But when you throw all of the things together in analysis, then it's very difficult to iron out the effects of all of these different variables that you have in a data set. You can basically get the same problems we have with epidemiological research, where some effects appear very strong in epidemiological research and they don't pan out in randomized controlled trials. Because when you actually start controlling for all the variables, not just with statistical wizardry, but actually by equating them between groups, the effects disappear. Mm-hmm. And there's a big limit to how much you can control for these covariates, especially when there's systematic bias. For example, let's say that there's a certain lab where they have they just have better instructors. So that lab generally gets better results than other labs. And let's say that lab is a proponent of training to failure. So in that lab, they generally find, like, regardless of their results, better results. And that can skew the total literature, especially if different labs have different study designs that they generally do, you can get very skewed results of what the total literature finding is. So you might think that training to failure is more important because of that. And you can also get differences between the sexes, where studies in, for example, have different ratios of men versus women. They have different training preferences or training MRVs, lots of different factors that can play a role.
Right, right. Speaking of the limitations of studies, how much do you think, like sometimes I'm having the feeling that the science, like evidence-based, like this study found this, like even referencing it in some cases when the study designs are so poor, it's just barely better than some guy just bullshitting on YouTube and just saying like a bunch of nonsense, where it's like, well, okay, like, yeah, you're referencing something, but like you and I both know that like someone like me, like having trained for 10 years, like it's the relevance is going to be almost nothing for me, which is okay. But then, you know, like who are you marketing to, or like not enough caveats are given. How do you feel about this now?
I think that is true when it comes to new things. So if there is, let's say there's a new topic that hasn't been studied before and somebody does a super crappy study on it, then yeah, we just don't really know anything yet. It's still, I would still say people generally undervalue the role of research unless it has systematic confounders. Like if it's just not so well controlled and stuff, that's not the biggest problem in the world, because anecdotes are never well controlled, and anecdotes don't have MRI scanners, and anecdotes don't have large sample sizes of other people doing the exact same training volume with at least decent control of confounding variables. So anecdotes are very, very, very low compared to even a crappy study. If it doesn't have like a massive systematic confounding effect, you know, like one group had a protein intake that was way higher. And like the high volume group had a much higher protein intake than a low volume group. And surprise, they got better results. Then that study shows, we don't know. It could be the volume, could be the protein intake, could be both. Well, it's one of those three pretty much, right? And yeah, that's all it tells you. But if it's something where we have five studies showing something and then we have another study coming out, yeah, it's a lot of limitations, but it trends in the same direction, then usually I do post about it. And then I will say like, this is in line with prior research. And typically list the biggest limitations of the study.
Okay, that makes sense. Just in the interest of time, I have like one very brief fun question for you for the end. First of all, I hope that your back is still good. I know that you had issues and it took quite a while to resolve it. I heard a very good talk from you back in like 2017 when you were talking about injury management, and you had some not super nice thing to say about the physiotherapist community. And I'm curious, like now after this little stint that you had, I'm guessing visiting a lot more of these professionals than maybe ever before, how do you feel about that community and the state of the industry right now?
Worse than ever. I can say that after having visited multiple professionals, I didn't even get a diagnosis. You talk to five people, you get five completely different opinions. The state of physiotherapy might even be worse than the state of bodybuilding, but because in bodybuilding, at least, there is consensus about some of the basics. Like you have to train hard, you have to do strength training, you need a high protein diet, watch your calories. Even the bros will, you know, often agree with that. So you can pretty much go to any bodybuilder. They will prescribe something to you for contest prep that is way too, involves way too much suffering and is not optimized by current scientific standards. It probably contains a few things that are probably even detrimental, but it probably is going to work. It's going to be viable.
Yeah.
Go to the average physiotherapist and you're lucky if that's the case. It's like the best case scenario is you just get some exercise that are nonsense, but it's better than moving around. But as a strength trainee, often things are very bad because you're already exercising. The advice they give can be super, super counterproductive. So if you look at Adam Meekins, for example, the sports physio, I really sympathize with his position. He's very vocal and sometimes somewhat coarse about the state of physiotherapy. But I think many of his posts make a lot of sense in light of how bad the field is. And for sure, there are good ones. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely not all bad. If you go to the average gym, the average PT is also going to be quite bad. So it's certainly not that physiotherapy is uniquely bad and the PTs are all better. Sure. It's a field that needs a lot of work and can benefit a lot from a more evidence-based approach.
Yeah. No, that's well said. All right, Manuel, I won't keep you up for any longer because I know you have a hard stop very soon. So, yep, I want to thank you for taking the time today. And I think we had a cool talk. So please just let people know where they can find you, any new projects, any of that stuff.
MenoHenselmans.com has everything. My email course is probably best for new subscribers. And yeah, YouTube now. So it's at Menno.Henselmans, both Instagram and YouTube. You can find all my stuff there.
Awesome. All right, Menno, it was a pleasure chatting with you.
Likewise, man.
Cool.